All right, so let's don't forget to sign in, please.
Sign in.
Good, thank you. Okay. All right. All right, so first of all, hello.
Hello.
It's really good to see those of you whom I know again, and I'm very happy that you reappeared for the community's sake. And if you're new to class, I'll explain what you got yourself into in a moment or two. But I can't individually say hello to all of you, but I know if you're pre-registered, I know that you're here because I read the registration list and I went, oh, that person's here, that person's here. If not, come see me and say hi. And if you don't, if I don't know you, introduce yourself. That way I'll know who I'm reading about each week when I check your name off on the registration list. Okay. Websites. On this board is a diagram which most of you have seen ad nauseum, but which I will explain briefly. But also, you'll notice there are two websites there. My personal website is here. It's got some stuff on it, some videos and audios and readings, drspencersherman.com. But the one to pay special attention to is swt.org/Spencer, which is courtesy of Robert Bernstein. And then the recordings of the class are done by Michael Hegelwald. So these two IT guys have managed to record all our classes and put them on swt.org/Spencer. So if you want to rehear a class, or if you weren't here and you want to know what happened in class, you just go to swt.org/Spencer. Thank you. That is a wonderful service. Oh, also stuff that I hand out, all kinds of stuff that other people hand out. There's all kinds of stuff on there. So it's a real treasure trove. Thank you both. Okay. All right, so what is this? Richard, yeah.
What does SWT stand for?
Say again, louder.
What does SWT stand for?
Stands for shorter work time.
SWT stands for shorter work time, which is a great idea.
Nice.
Okay. All right, so in a nutshell, this class is about becoming more conscious of your inner world and of the outer world, such that you can more effectively navigate the outer world and influence it for the better. And right now, I think it needs that influence. So each class begins with, we sit together in mindfulness for 10 minutes, and then we go to the lesson of the class. So that's what we're going to do this morning, but before that, I have a few announcements to make about stuff that's happening at the School of Extended Learning. Oh, I want to, this is on my, oh, on your right and my left is this person, Lisa Draper, without whom this whole thing would have fallen down long ago. So Lisa, I just wanted to publicly thank you. She's the one that makes sure that this all gets organized, or not disorganized. Okay, all right, so here's what's up and coming for this class. Today is the NESS class, N-E-S-S.
What's that stand for?
We're gonna look at three things today. We're gonna look at mindfulness briefly, and then we'll sit. I realize that most of you are very practiced and don't need any coaching in it, but there are some new folks in the class, and I just want to kind of make sure that everybody's on the same seat. So first mindfulness. Then we'll talk about egolessness, which is the advanced class. And after that, if there's time, we'll talk about happiness, And if we don't get all three of those things done this morning, happiness can wait for next week. All right. Okay. So that's what's happening this week. Next week, I'm not going to. Next week is a class about. At this point, I haven't drafted it completely, but it's about something happening in the world that's changing the world.
What does egolessness mean?
Egolessness? I'm getting there.
Okay.
We're not there yet.
Okay.
Okay. I guess I don't have to yell, right? I've got a microphone.
Yes.
Then in 2 weeks, Carl Blaise, is Carl here?
Not here.
Today? Carl Blaise is going to talk to us about the newest research in placebo. Placebo is really getting a lot of attention now, for very good reason. And Carl is, those of you who know, Carl is a class member who is an actual rocket scientist, and he's become interested in biology. And he's got a PhD from Caltech in planetary sciences, and he has a 40-year career with NASA and JPL. So he's a real rocket scientist. Anyway, he's going to talk to us about the newest developments in our understanding of placebo and what it can do and why it works. That's in 2 weeks. And then in 3 weeks, on the 7th of February, Mark McGinnis is going to come to class. How many people know who Mark McGinnis is? Raise your hand. Yes. He's an amazing dude. He won't come on stilts. He's the guy that walks every solstice break on stilts. But he's also the founder of the Environmental Defense Center, the Community Education Council, and a professor at UCSB.
What does he teach?
He teaches ecological awareness.
What's that mean?
It means awareness of what's going on in the world, especially the world, the natural world, and how human beings are impacting what's going on in the natural world, and what we need to do to keep the natural world natural. So he's going to come in 3 weeks, okay? All right, so several classes you ought to know about. Peter Wright, who is that person? Many of you, he's been a longtime class member. Many of you know him. When it gets closer to his class, I'll have him announce in more detail what the class is. But I just wanted to make you aware that on Saturday, the 29th of February and the 3rd of March, he's teaching a class called Get Guidance from Your Higher Self, in which you will experience dialoguing with your higher self. And some of you have taken that class. If not, you might want to. Second, Svetlana Meret, who has come and talked to our class once a couple of years ago, is going to teach a class on Saturday, March 14th and March 21st, called Sacred Sites, Healing Sanctuaries of Antiquity, where she's going to talk about the various sacred sites that she has visited. Mary Beth. Yeah.
I registered for that class and just got a notice that it was canceled.
Really? Okay, so Svetlana's not going to teach that class, I guess. If it changes, let me know. If they email you differently, that's too bad. She's really a resource. She's really a great person.
Could you repeat the one that Mark's
going to
teach?
Mark McGinnis, he's going to be here on February 7th.
What were the ones on the Saturday?
That's Peter Wright's class. And it's called Get Guidance from Your Higher Self. Can you hear this still?
Yes.
Good. Okay, Dave Humes, who many of you know, is going to teach two classes. One on Saturday, the 8th of February, on dreams and how spirit guides script them. And then on the 18th of April, the spiritual power of music. So Dave Humes has two classes coming up.
And when's he going to come to this class?
And, let's say again?
When's he going to come to this
class? He's not going to come to this class.
How come?
Because he's got his own class.
What?
He's got his own class.
No,
I didn't invite him.
Every year.
What?
He has to come every year.
No, Dave Rico comes every year.
David, he was one I went to see what.
Yeah, Dave Rico.
Tell him he's coming here, we're at the bar. I'm still having you.
Say again?
I'm coming here, we're at the bar. Tell him.
All right, I will.
Okay.
All right, so, and last but not, certainly not least, Mind and Supermind on April 20th. Chris Bache is going to come and talk to us about LSD and the mind of the universe. And many of you know about that research because we looked at it deeply last term, but if not, you might want to go to YouTube and search Chris Bache and have your mind blown. His book just came out, so if you want to get his book, it just came out, LSD and the Mind of the Universe, Diamonds from Heaven. I don't know what's going to happen. Either that book is not going to get well-known for a while. It's going to have to build, and it'll be a modest group at the Wake Center to hear him. But if it gets, if that book gets noticed and reviewed in the right place, then you're going to have to get tickets early for that lecture.
What is David? I don't think we're going to come to the class.
David's not, because he doesn't overlap. He's coming back from San Francisco just when our class ends, and he doesn't, he's not free that last Friday.
So
he's not coming. All right, enough business. Let's talk about mindfulness a little bit, and then we'll do some. All right, so we can look at mindfulness as having three components. Component one, relaxation. How do you create relaxation? By being mindful. You focus on your breathing, and then you soften. You let everything soften. You let your body soften. You let your mind soften. You let your heart soften. So you focus on your breathing. You don't try to change it. You just notice whatever's moving. And you let everything, body, mind, and heart, soften. Step one. If you do nothing else but that, it will have great mental and physical benefit. But there are additional steps. Step two. Open. How do you open? You feel your breathing, and then you invite opening around your breathing. You keep awareness of your breathing, and then you allow yourself to open around the breathing. So what do you open? You let your body open. If you're holding tension, if you're holding yourself together, you just allow an opening of those constrictions. So you let your body open. You let your mind open. So you're not preoccupied by anything. There's a spaciousness in your mind, and thoughts can happen. They can come and they can go without impedance. There's a great area in which, there's a great field in which they can move. You let your heart open, so you're not blocking any feelings. You're opening so that the feelings can flow through the spaciousness that you are. So you breathe and you open. Third step, you notice whatever's taking place. How? Keep coming back with your attention to your breathing. Your attention will leave your breathing frequently. Bring your attention back to your breathing every time you notice that it's gone. Now, at first, you'll get lost in stuff, typically thought, for a period of time. And after a while, you'll go, oh my God, I can't feel my breathing. Then you come back to it. And then you get lost again, and then you come back to it. But after a while, you're able to stay with your breathing, with the movement of your belly in and out, with the slight movement of your chest, with the air in and out of your nostrils, with the whole body opening and closing subtly with your breathing. So you can feel that fairly continuously, and you notice other stuff, thoughts, feelings, other sensations. In time, this ability to stay aware of what's happening while it's happening will become stronger. That is, you'll get lost less frequently for less long. And in considerable, as you progress in your practice, you'll gain the ability to maintain a witnessing awareness, that is, to take a step back from your experience and notice everything that's happening, including your breathing, while it's happening. You'll just be, instead of being these things absorbed in this, you will be here an awareness, a wide open awareness of thoughts when they happen, feelings when they happen, sensations as they happen. So it's simply these three steps are a way to get you from absorption in thoughts, feelings, and body to awareness of thoughts, feelings, and body. But you can't think your way into mindfulness. The way to do it is find your breathing, bring your attention back to your breathing, let yourself soften and open, and the noticing will happen by itself. Okay. So let's sit for 10 minutes. I think what I'm going to do is not be entirely silent, but a few times coach you very briefly. So you hear my voice a couple of times just reminding you not to be lost in La La Land. But other than that, you can sit silently. And then in future weeks, I won't bother you at all with my voice, okay? So let's sit for 10 minutes. Yeah, I'll close it. That's a good idea. So Thich Nhat Hanh says, sit like a mountain. John Kabat-Zinn says, sit with dignity. This is an important thing to do. I'll ring the bell now, and I'll ring it in 10 minutes. This is not a question of thinking differently. It's a question of being aware of your breathing, softening and opening, and noticing what's happening while remaining aware of your breathing.
just be aware of your breathing. Don't try to change anything. Let everything be just as it is. Simply feel your breathing. Let yourself soften. Let yourself open. Just feel what's moving as you breathe and let yourself soften around your breathing. Let yourself open at all levels, and it will be easy to notice whatever's occurring. Don't try to change anything or do anything. Just feel your breathing. Thank you.
That was lovely. I'm going to see if I can turn the heat off. Sitting, I realized that I didn't say one thing that I should, which is, why are we doing this? Why are we sitting here in silence for 10 minutes counting up and finding our breathing? Very succinctly, when the weather is good, it's okay to be your thoughts, your feelings, and your body. When the weather's not so good, it's really nice to take a step back from that and watch the storm rather than get soaked. Also, from here, you can see how this works really clearly. And you can make very deft and skillful and effective changes in this because you have a clear view of it. Amy.
Do you find sometimes when you sit in the stillness and openness, observing that thoughts of guidance guiding thoughts come in that seem to address something?
Yeah, when this is less noisy and preoccupied, when you're here, then you're open to aspects of reality that are usually masked by the usual activity of this stuff. So the more time you spend here, the more you redefine yourself from these things to the awareness of these things, then the awareness includes more than these things.
Mm-hmm. Nicely put.
All right, so let's talk about egolessness. I don't like sitting so far back from you. Wait. I need a hand. I need actually two hands. I need somebody to help me carry this thing. Michael, we're going to put this in the middle there so I don't have to sit on the stage. I don't want to sit on the stage. It's too far. About like that, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Is this safe here?
That can go, yeah, that can stay there.
Okay.
Stay there, sure. No, I'm going to sit on it. Okay. So this is a, what do they call it, disclaimer at the beginning, you know, before you get into something, or the fine print underneath the advertisement. So this is the fine print. I don't know that I'm the best person to talk about egoless. So everything I say, there'll be time for discussion and then people can correct me. Okay. Amongst the great Buddhist teachings, I think there are three that are very foundational. So those three foundational Buddhist teachings, and again, I'm not the best person to talk about Buddhism, but as I understand it, the three foundational Buddhist teachings are non-attachment, impermanence, and no self or egolessness. Well, let's talk about each of them very briefly, and then we'll talk about egolessness in more detail. So non-attachment is a fairly understandable idea. Buddha explained it using the Four Noble Truths. First Noble Truth. Unenlightened life involves a lot of suffering. Second Noble Truth. The cause of suffering is attachment, also known as desire, grasping, aversion, trying to hold on to the world. So, First Noble Truth is the cause of, First Noble Truth is unenlightened life is filled with suffering. Second Noble Truth is the cause of the suffering is attachment. Third Noble Truth, the freedom from suffering is non-attachment. And the Fourth Noble Truth is the Eightfold Path, the way that one achieves non-attachment. So that makes it's fairly easy to understand, yeah? The more you care about something, the more you are governed by what happens to it. If you really care about something that's going well, you're very happy. If you don't care, if you really care about something that's going poorly, you're really unhappy. You're prey to the vicissitudes of what happens to what you care about. So the prescription is to let go of that caring, and then to let go of that attachment, that strong holding. And therefore, you're free from suffering. That's not necessarily free from pain. Okay. Life is painful sometimes, but suffering is to multiply the pain by how much you're attached to what's happening. When life was a more difficult process than it is now, this philosophy and psychology served very well. It allowed you to be less plagued by life. But our lives have changed much for the better from 2,600 years ago or prior. And so this idea of complete non-attachment is no longer so necessary or so doesn't attract us so much. So there's a synthesis of ancient Eastern ideas and contemporary Western ideas that is evolving as we sit here. In the East, it's, if you want to feel happier, if you want to feel less plagued, then let go of care. In the West, it's, you don't like it, change it to make it better. So be very attached, be very caring. The synthesis seems to be to be caring enough, but not to know when to care and how much to care. To have the wisdom to decide about when you're going to take action and how passionately you're going to take that action and how invested you're going to be in the result. My
But there is a distinction between needs and desires, right? Because desire may cause pain and the suffering you talk about, but to meet our needs is a good thing.
Yeah, and we're actually going to talk about that in much more detail later. But the idea is, it's important to understand what you care about and to make a good choice about how much you care about it and how much you're going to get invested in trying to change it. So that's the first of the three basic teachings, which is non-attachment. The second one is very easy to understand, is teaching about impermanence. And we all realize that things change and that you kind of can't hold on to anything forever. So I'm not going to... So the current understanding, the current synthesis of East and West about impermanence is to realize that nothing is going to stay the way it is. So difficult stuff will have a tendency to, will change. But also the stuff that you care about, that you like, the important thing is to appreciate it fully while it's present, because it's not going to be present forever. So in the teaching of impermanence helps us to more fully be appreciative of what's happening right now. Honey?
Caring and desire are part of my essence. And it's really important to let go at those times that I guess you're referring to as attached, right?
Yeah. Oh, there are degrees of attachment. There's unhealthy attachment and there's healthy attachment. And there's also a time to hold on and there's a time to let go. And you have to know how to do that, right?
And caring and desire, though, are part of who we are.
They arise because we are alive.
Right.
Yeah. And they're not... To be completely dispassionate would not be fully alive.
Right.
But to be entirely caught up in what's happening would be miserable.
Absolutely.
All right. But again, this is all preemptive. Bernie, you want to say?
And I think it also depended on what your desire was. If your desire was killing dogs, that wouldn't be a very good desire, you know.
Well, you wouldn't act on that desire.
Right. Okay.
A lot of us have unhealthy desires, so we have the wisdom to not act them. Okay. So that's it. So the first two things are fairly simple to understand: non-attachment and impermanence. The third is no self, egolessness, and that's not so easy. So I enlisted some help. I'm going to read a short article by Mark Epstein. How many people know who Mark Epstein is? Raise your hand if you do. He's a psychiatrist who has written, and a Zen master, who has written extensively on the confluence between East and West. He's a very credible voice. And I'm going to read from a book that some of you may know, was one of the first transpersonal psychology books a long time ago, called Paths Beyond Ego, by Walsh and Vaughn. And it's a wonderful book. So I'm just going to read about two pages that Mark Epstein wrote about egolessness, called The Varieties of Egolessness. And I'm going to read a little bit, and then I'm going to translate, or I'm going to expatiate a little on what he says. There are now several common misconceptions about the key Buddhist notion of anatta, or egolessness. To begin with, many new meditators mistake egolessness for the abandonment of the Freudian ego. Ego means self. I got to tell you about Freud. So Freud said, at first, there's no self. because all your needs are immediately taken care of by the world. You're in the mother's womb, and there's no need for self. Everything's taken care of. You're born and you're at the mother's breast. There's no need for a sense of self. Everything is taken care of. But as you develop, you start to realize that you are separate from the world, and you have to operate on the world in order to get your needs met. You have to cry. You have to crawl toward or push away from. So there becomes a sense of me separate from the world. That's the ego. To begin with, many new meditators mistake egolessness for the abandonment of the Freudian ego, that is, a sense of self. Conventional notions of ego as that which modulates sexual and aggressive strivings have led many Americans to mistakenly equate egolessness with a kind of primal scream in which the person is finally freed from all limiting constraints. Egolessness is understood here as the equivalent of Wilhelm Reich's orgasmic potency, and the ego is identified as anything that tenses the body, obscures the capacity for pleasurable discharge, or gets in the way of feeling free. Popularized in the 60s, this view remains deeply embedded in the popular imagination. It sees the route to egolessness as a process of unlearning, of casting off the shackles of civilization and returning to a childlike forthrightness. It also tends to romanticize regression, psychosis, and any uninhibited expression of emotion. So what he's saying here is, when we think about the ego this way, we think about the ego as that which imprisons us. It keeps us sexually repressed. It keeps us from feeling our feelings. And what we need to do is break it. And then we're totally free to act on our desires and to feel our feelings and to not be constrained by our adulthood. And what he's saying is that's not what the Buddhist notion of egolessness is all about. Okay? That's one, it's a misunderstanding. That what you want to do is get rid of your sense of self and all those things you've learned about who you are and just be free. Another popular misconception is that egolessness is some kind of oneness or merger, a forgetting of the self with the simultaneous identification with what lies outside the ego, a trance state, or an ecstatic union. Freud described the oceanic feeling, the quote, oceanic feeling, end quote, as a sense of limitless and unbounded oneness with the universe that seeks the, quote, restoration of limitless narcissism, end quote, and the, quote, resurrection of infantile helplessness, end quote. Thus, egolessness is identified with the infantile state prior to the development of ego, that is, that of the infant in the womb or at the breast, making no distinction between itself and its mother, but rather merged in a symbiotic and undifferentiated union. One word about this. I'll say something about it and then I'll read a little bit more about it. So if the first mistake is to think that the Buddhist notion of egolessness means being free of the constraints of the self, the second mistake is to feel that the teaching of egolessness involves merging entirely with the universe, being in a state of blissful oneness. This formulation is complicated by the fact that there really are states accessible in meditation that do provide such feelings of harmony, merger, and loss of ego boundaries. But these are not the states that define the Buddhist notion of egolessness. So you can have unitive states, that's called mystical experience, but it's not what anatta is all about. Egolessness is not a return to feelings of infancy.
an experience of undifferentiated bliss or immersion with the mother, even though many people may seek such an experience when they begin to meditate, and even though some may actually find a version of it. So a lot of us feel like it would be great to be free from who we are, and we could come into universal love that we are entirely consumed by and one with. That would be great. But there's another teaching here. A third and more so what he's doing first is he's going to knock down all of these ideas that we have about where we're going when we get enlightened, okay? So this is a difficult thing to read because, yeah, I kind of wish that I thought that I could get free of my suspense. And I kind of thought that I could get into oneness, you know, and so he's kind of saying, well, it's not that, not that. Not that those things might not be to some extent desirable, but he's saying there's something else here. Okay? A third and more interpersonal view of egolessness suggests a kind of subjugation of the self to the other. It is as if the idealized merger experience is projected onto interpersonal relationships in what Gestalt therapists have called confluence, or loss of interpersonal ego boundaries. This is really a kind of thinly disguised masochism. The psychoanalyst Annie Reich, A-N-N-I-E, Reich, in a classic paper on self-regulation in women, describes this very well. Quote, femininity, end quote, she says, is often, quote, equated with complete annihilation, end quote. The only way to recover needed self-esteem is then to merge or fuse with a glorified or idealized other whose greatness or power she can then incorporate. For both sexes, something similar exists in spiritual circles. Meditators with this misunderstanding are vulnerable to a kind of eroticized attachment to teachers, gurus, or other intimates toward whom they direct their desire to be released into abandon. So a third misconception is that you let go of yourself and completely give yourself to another. You lose your ego boundary and you become identified with something better than yourself. A fourth, and you see that a lot in spiritual communities where people will give up everything to their teacher. A fourth common misconception, popular in so-called transpersonal psychology circles, stems from a misreading of important papers by Ken Wilber and Jack Engler. The belief here is that egolessness is a developmental stage beyond the ego, that the ego must first exist and then be abandoned. This is the flip side of the belief that egolessness precedes the development of the ego. Here it is seen as that which succeeds the ego. So the idea is, first I didn't have an ego because I was in the womb or at the breast. Now I have an ego. Eventually I'll get to the state where I let go of my ego and I'm egoless. A lot of us have that idea, you know, we're going to go beyond and we're going to transcend the ego. This approach implies that the ego, which while important developmentally, can in some sense be transcended or left behind. Here we run into an unfortunate mix of vocabulary. The system referred to by these formulations is the Western psychodynamic psychology of ego development. That is, you don't have an ego, then you have an ego. Then there is a jump or a switch to an Eastern-based spiritual vocabulary that makes it seem as if the ego that has been formed is the same ego that's being abandoned. Didn't have one, now I got one, now you're getting rid of it. Yet listen to the Dalai Lama on this point. Quote, now we're getting to what it really is from the Buddhist point of view. Selflessness is not a case of something that existed in the past becoming non-existent. Selflessness is not a case of something that existed in the past becoming non-existent. Rather, this sort of self is something that never did exist. What is needed is to identify as non-existent something that always was non-existent.
Wait a minute, you mean I don't exist? What's going on here?
Can you say that again?
Yeah. This is the Dalai Lama's words, right?
Selflessness is not a case of something that existed in the past becoming non-existent. Rather, this sort of self is something that never did exist. What is needed is to identify as non-existent something that always was non-existent.
Right, so what he's going to explain, so he's not going to leave us there.
My question.
Yeah.
What happened to self-love?
We'll get there. Okay. So this is a little steep, I think, for some folks, but that's okay. Okay. It is not ego. Now, there's a reason I'm doing. I'm bringing you to this academic exercise. Okay, there's a down to earth good reason. So bear with all this heady stuff because we're going to get to the lesson. It is not ego in the Freudian sense that's the spiritual target of Buddhist insight. It is rather the self concept, the representational component of the ego. The actual internal experience of oneself that is targeted. So, it is not ego in the Freudian sense, that is a separate sense of self, that is the actual target of the Buddhist insight. It is rather the self-concept, the representational component of the ego, the actual internal experience of one's selfhood that is targeted. What is being transcended here is not the entire ego. Rather, self-representation is revealed as lacking concrete existence. It is not the case of something real being eliminated, but of the essential groundlessness being realized for what it always has been. In the words of the Dalai Lama, quote, this seemingly solid, concrete, independent, self-instituting I, me, under its own power that appears, actually does not exist at all. So what he's saying is, yeah, you're separate than the world, and you operate as a separate creature. You go get what you need, you avoid what would hurt you. That is not going to go away. It's good to have a sense of self. But what's going to go away is the idea you have of who you are. The mental construction that you have made of me and what's good for me and what's not good for me and what I should and shouldn't do and all the thoughts you have continuously about yourself. You say, that gets in the way. In my words, it's not that we don't have enough self. It's that we have too much self. It's not a question of letting go of self. You'd get in a lot of trouble if you had no boundary, no way to navigate the world, no sense of self-protection, no sense of what you need. What's the problem is that you isolate yourself from the world by continuously erecting this idea of yourself between yourself and actually getting what you need. Okay. A little further, and then I'll go deeper into that. Meditators with this misunderstanding often feel under pressure to disavow critical aspects of their ego. So meditators with this misunderstanding, many of us, often feel under pressure to disavow critical aspects of their being that are identified with the unwholesome ego. Most commonly, sexuality, aggression, critical thinking, or even the active use of the first-person pronoun are relinquished. The general idea being that to give these things up or to let these things go is to achieve egolessness.
I don't have any desires. I don't even have an I.
Aspects of the self are set up as an enemy, and then attempts are made by the meditator to distance oneself from them.
That's the bad me, I gotta get rid of it. But the qualities that are identified as unwholesome are actually empowered by the attempts to repudiate them. If you want to get rid of it, you're actually actualizing it as something to get rid of. A final misunderstanding of egolessness is one that sees it as a thing in and of itself, a state to be achieved or aspired to. Here, the need to identify something as existing in its own right is manifest. And the belief in the ego as concretely existent is, in some sense, transferred to the belief in egolessness as concretely existent. It's not that the ego disappears, but that the belief in the ego's solidity, the identification with the ego's representations, it is not that the ego disappears, but that the belief in the ego's solidity, the identification with the ego's representations, is abandoned in the realization of egolessness. So what he said here is, egolessness isn't a thing. It's not something that you can get or achieve. Right. So, thank you for bearing with the abstruse lesson. Now I'm going to talk to you very personally about the only two ways that I understand all this stuff. I mean, I understand all the stuff he said not to do. I just don't understand so well the stuff he said to do. So, what is egolessness if it's not all this stuff that I just had to throw out the window? So I understand it in, from my own experience, in two ways. One way is when I sit and meditate, it becomes very clear to me that there is an awareness that is noticing a lot of words and pictures in my head, thoughts. And those thoughts, whenever I have one of those thoughts, it creates a me. There's no me when there's just open awareness and a sound and a smell and a feeling. There's really no me. But the minute that I say, oh, I'm having a feeling, me pops up. So the sense of something that I understand myself to be is different than my actual experience of living at this moment. And that when it's quiet and open, there's not this idea. That one, a lot of us have. But there's, I'll say one more one. I've said this once in class, so I won't belabor, I won't say it at any length, but I had one experience which gave me a hint about this teaching. I went to see Ting Sha. How many people have seen Ting Sha? They're a group of five musicians who have these instruments from all over the world that they bring once a season to some place like the what do they usually bring it? They usually bring it to Trinity Church on Staten and Michipurena, and 50 people come and we all do a ceremonial, seasonal kind of ceremony at the beginning, and then we go into another room and we lie around in a circle, and they, for about a half an hour, they improvise on these wonderful instruments. It's just wonderful to hear all the wonderful sounds and kind of trip out on it. So I went to one of these some years ago, and I was sitting in the first room where we have a little seasonal altar. It was autumn, so a lot of people bring things to put on the altar. So I brought a leaf like everybody else did, you know. And I was just sitting there waiting for the whole thing to begin. And I wasn't in an altered state of consciousness, and I wasn't really meditating. I was just kind of sitting, waiting.
And the weirdest thing happened, which is something left me that I didn't even know that I had. I was just sitting there, and then I felt, just sitting there quietly, and then maybe it was because of all these wonderful people that were there also. I have no reason for it. I wasn't doing a lot of meditation or anything. But this layer, a thick layer of stuff, like I was wearing a 2-foot thick coat, and this thick layer just got, it just wasn't there anymore. And I realized, just as it was happening, that this layer was me. It was the conditioned me that I had learned about all through my life and that I had been building up such that it was a filter between the world and the perceiver. It was this, everything had to come through this me. All this conditioning about I like, I don't like, it's me, it's not, you know, it was just the me layer. And when it went away, it was just the best feeling, the clearest feeling, the most open feeling. But I knew who I was, I knew exactly what was happening, I even knew it was called Kensho, which is the first glimpse of enlightenment, which is probably all I ever get. But for about 2.5 hours, during the ceremony and then during the Ting Shaw concert, and then walking back home with a guy who was asked to walk with me, who was having trouble with his marriage and just wanted to talk about it, I just stayed in this state of without that me all around me. And I knew it was going to come back. And I knew that it came by grace. I didn't earn it in any way. But I just wanted to experience it while it was happening, you know. After having had that experience, it came back. It took about 2.5 hours, and I felt it coming back that evening. And I was okay. But ever since that time, I've been able to feel this ego layer. That's what they're talking about. The idea of me and the conditioning that I've had and the filter that I have, the semi-permeable barrier that I have between me and the world. So that's the only way I understand this. But I think the take-home lesson of egolessness is the more you think about yourself and stay self-involved, the more miserable you will be.
Yeah.
Not that you never think about yourself, then that's kind of risky. But the self-preoccupation, the walking around the world with rear-view mirror, so that you're really always looking at yourself, and mostly pay attention to yourself. How am I doing? Does she like me? Does he like me? Are they understanding me? What does that mean for me? All this me stuff, it doesn't leave very much of you to actually make contact. And it doesn't leave very much space for the world to actually come in. Because there's this me layer. So my East and West marriage contemporary synthesis of what the East tells us to do, which is let go of self, to some extent, and what the West tells us to do is build a strong self, right? That's what Western psychology is all, build a strong sense of ego. To put them both together, I think the teaching is to have enough self, but not too much self. And to be able to let go of self into activities and other people when it's appropriate, and to be able to let go fully into activities and other people. You know what, because we talked about it, you know what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi says is the secret to happiness? Flow. What is flow? Getting completely lost in what you're doing. So there's no you between you and what you're doing. And one of the ways you can get lost is into conversation or into relation to other people. But the minute you pull back from that, to me, there's a lessening of the fulfillment of what you're doing. Robert, yeah. Oh, so where's the yellow sheet? Is that still coming around?
Okay.
Okay, so it's over there. Okay. The yellow sheet of sign up. So how do you do this? How do you achieve this self, but not too much self. Well, the instinctual way you're going to do this is the wrong way, which is you're going to think about yourself. How could I be the best myself? That's going to build this layer, this construction. The way you do this is you look beyond that construction. You don't try to get rid of you thinking about yourself. You instead look beyond it to how you can go, how you can connect more completely with what you're doing and who you're with. You shift your attention from blah, 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 to, and it's a shift of attention. It's just what we've been practicing. You go, instead of being in my head, I can be, and I can, when I listen to somebody, instead of listening with half an ear and thinking about my own thoughts and what I'm going to respond, I can listen to the person mindfully, which is breathing and open and sharing their experience completely, becoming one with their experience.
I found the most rewarding kind of flow for me is service.
Yeah, because it's so, what Michael said is surfing is the most rewarding.
Service. Service.
Oh, service. Yeah, let's say, I guess I'll do two things. Okay, in service, you have to, you're bringing your energy to somebody else or something else. You can't say service is about somebody, something else or somebody else. The reason I said surfing is because when something is so demanding that you don't have any attention left over to think about yourself, then you merge with what you're doing. And surfers frequently talk in semi-mystical terms about what they do, because it's hard to, you don't have any, if you think about yourself, gee, I'm doing a good job here. it takes all your attention to stay in agreement. So I'm here.
This happens in art, when you're involved in producing an art piece of artwork, or when you're listening to music, or probably dancing.
Okay, so artists talk about flow a lot. It's when Csikszentmihalyi was first studying flow, he studied artists to begin with. And artists and athletes were his first interviewees. But there's two kinds of artists. Not so good artists construct their art from a sense of eye. What would look good here? What would make a better, there's a lot of intellection. There's a lot of, no, that's not right. There's a lot of staying in your own thought process. But when you've got great technique, when you've mastered the art form, then it comes through you. You don't construct it from you. It is transcended to you, or it's beyond you. You have to be very good to be able to do that. So let's see. What's your first name?
Shelley. So where does it fit in discovering the aspects of the me that you have created in your life that has conditioned you to see the world or experience the world? Your distortions, your...
Yeah. So Shelley's saying, what do you do about, is this a fair way to say, what do you do about the fact that you have this me created? When it's not serving you to be bound in yourself, when you realize that you're too caught up in your what's going on with you, then you notice that you're doing that, and then you give yourself a little love for being insecure in this situation, and then you redirect your attention. But you don't get down on yourself for selfing, because then you make more self, right? So I think it's a question of just kind of having compassion for yourself and the fact that you've developed this armor because you needed it. And now it's in, it's between you and something that you love. So you say, okay, it's okay, kid, it's okay. And you go beyond it. You just bring your attention beyond it. Is that a reasonable way to look at it? All right, let's see. So Susan.
In the 60s, I was fortunate to meet Krishnamurti. And in the 60s, I was fortunate to meet Krishnamurti. And then, of course, many of us have been fortunate to hear him speak or see his talks and books. And he emphasized the quality of observation, to observe, as a state of not intellectualizing, of just observing. You know, the things we're talking about what self and how this doing this or having this attitude, how does that make me feel or what does that do to my life? Observation, yeah. Having that.
Now, unfortunately, if you don't have, if you haven't practiced mindfulness, then there's going to be a lot of thought. You can't just kind of automatically observe. The minute you observe, there's going to be a thought that's going to label it. So that's okay. You just observe the thought too. You can always take a step back from what's happening and observe what's ever happening. But you can't necessarily clear your mind. It would be great if we could just go abracadabra and my mind is clear. Maybe one more comment, and then I have to talk to us about happiness, because that's the third thing. Okay, how do you do that? So Annie.
I've come to a place within myself where I can distinguish between the eternal and temporary. My ego is temporary, as is my body and sensations and all that, but there's an eternal part of me, or an infinite part of me, and the ego is just the one that's informed and that crafts a personality and is temporal.
Yeah.
Well, what would you say?
I would say that's a good way to look at it. If there's some deeper, more in your words, eternal part of ourselves, then the ego is the way that is interfaces with the world.
Yes.
It's like another metaphor. The ego is like clothes. Okay. You are the body, and you're wearing this interface with the world called the ego, called the personality, called the sense of self. Okay. It's necessary to have some clothes, otherwise it's too cold, it's too hot. Other people don't necessarily want to see you. So the point is, clothes are good. Okay. It's nice to have a sense of self, but you don't want 17 layers of clothes. But we keep constructing, as we go through life, through our conditioning, more and more layers of clothes. The idea would be to have the appropriate clothes, sometimes to have more clothes, sometimes to have less clothes, depending on the situation that you're in. You're the body, the sense of self, the ego, the personality, the clothes. Okay. All right, so let's talk about happiness. Happiness is a big subject. I'm going to give you one way to look at it now, but it is by no means the only way to look at happiness. But it ties into what we've just been saying, so I'll kind of give it. Okay, and some of you have heard me talk about this at greater length last semester. Others of you haven't. But very simply, one way to look at happiness is there was a fundamental change in the universe as we know it. About 4 billion years ago. The universe itself, this particular universe, there may be other universes, maybe a multiverse, but this particular universe that we currently think is 13.8 billion years old, it came into being with the Big Bang, so 13.8 billion years ago, there was a Big Bang and the universe appeared. 4.56 billion years ago, this solar system coalesced, the sun and the planets coalesced, and very shortly thereafter on Earth, something very strange happened. Now, this very strange thing may have happened at other places in the universe at other times, or in other universes, or at other times on this Earth. But the only thing we know for sure is that about 4 billion years ago, non-living matter somehow agglomerated itself enough to start living. And that was a fundamental shift in the structure of the universe. Non-living elements became a living thing. When that happened, a distinction between living arose from non-living and the livingness that happened had one fundamental job. The non-living universe didn't have any job, it just was. But the living universe had a job, which is to stay alive. Otherwise, if it didn't operate on the universe to keep it alive, it would fall back into non-life. Anything that's alive has to strive to remain alive. Otherwise, by its nature, it comes apart into non-life. So the basic motive of livingness is to stay alive. I'm not sure if you have these. Everything that is alive on, and as far as we know at this point, it's only on this planet, okay, but it may be elsewhere. But everything that's alive is part of the same thing, life. So how did life figure out how to remain alive? Three strategies. Strategy one, it figured out that it needed to diversify. It needed to become more than little organic molecules, but it needed to become plants, and it needed to become animals, and it needed to become all kinds of different species. So that if this form of life wasn't viable in this location, then another form of life might be. So life has come from its unitary beginnings to be very diversified. Lots of different kinds of plants and animals, all of which are expressions of the same thing. They're all fundamentally life trying to stay alive. Second strategy that life came up with to remain alive is reproduce, because it hasn't been able to figure out how to keep any particular part of it alive infinitely. That is, all things that are alive eventually die. So if life wants to remain alive, it has to come up with a reproduction strategy. So everything that's alive reproduces and continues life. And then in some species, life has decided to have a helping motive, a service motive, so that other life forms can continue to remain alive. So life assures its continuance by motivating each life form, or many life forms, to help other life forms stay alive. So I think it's a very basic motive. Service is a very basic motive of life. So in human beings, there are four basic needs which serve this fundamental motivation to stay alive. So all of us are governed by these four needs, and everything that we do is an expression of one or more of these needs. If you look deeper into anything that motivates us, it motivates us because we're trying to satisfy one or more of these needs. So what are the four basic needs? First basic need, these basic needs, this is my formulation, but it's exactly the first four chakras in Hinduism, and it's a pretty good translation of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, those of you who know those systems. So the first basic need is health and safety. The body, first chakra, the body needs to remain okay. The body needs to remain viable and non-threatened. So health and safety is the first basic need. Second basic need, second chakra, pleasure. Any life form needs to be able to go to what will help its life, build its life, and needs to go away, displeasure, from that which will hurt it. So any life form, to stay alive, has to go toward the good stuff and away from the bad stuff. And the signal of that is pleasure and displeasure. That's the second chakra. Third basic need is a sense of self, a sense of me as part of the world but separate from it. A sense of the fact that I am a being with needs. And I parse the sense of self into three parts. Identity, knowing what my needs are. Autonomy, having the freedom to meet my needs. And ability, having the capability to meet my needs. So, third chakra, sense of self. Strong ability to know myself, to get my needs met, and to be able to do that. So, identity, autonomy, ability, sense of self, third basic need, and fourth basic need, connection. Life forms, you're not viable alone. We need one another. It's a process of life helping life. So connection. In the Hindu system, this would be fourth chakra. I include the arms in the fourth chakra. It's not only a question of feeling, it's also a question of embracing. So what about happiness? What is happiness from this biological point of view? What is happiness? Happiness is how the organism is when all the needs are satisfied. If you tune into to yourself when all your needs are satisfied, you say, I am happy. What that means is these four basic needs are satisfied. If you're unhappy, you say, I'm not happy today. If you tune into yourself, you realize that one or more basic needs is not satisfied. And that's valuable information. What you need to do then is say, well, why am I unhappy? What basic need is not satisfied? And how do I go about getting it satisfied? So happiness is a signal that life is being maintained and increased, and unhappiness is a signal that something is leaking out of the life system, or is not supporting the life system. And so unhappiness is very valuable because it tells you that there's something you need to do. And different kinds of unhappiness have to do with different unsatisfied needs. So you have to say to yourself, you know, how am I doing with these four basic needs? What basic need is satisfied or is not satisfied here? Or what set of basic needs is not satisfied? And what strategy can I adopt to get those needs satisfied? I think that's the essence of therapy, by the way, those of you who are therapists. This is really what we're talking about. It's really about basic needs and how to satisfy them. So when somebody goes, ouch, it's not that there's something wrong with them, it's that there's something right with them. What they're saying is, ouch, one of my basic needs isn't satisfied. What can I do to get that satisfied? And sometimes, a lot of time, the problem isn't in the person. The problem is in the environment they're in. It's in the life they're leading. And the prescription is not change you, but change where you are. Because it's the world that is helping, is the way your life situation is getting in the way of your needs getting satisfied. Not that you're screwed up. It's that you're in a situation that is not viable. So what? How does this relate to conflicts between people or countries or any other two entities? Well, everybody's right in a basic sense. When people disagree or countries disagree, what they're really saying is one or more of my basic needs is not being satisfied in our relationship. And if the relationship is going to improve, two things need to happen. First, both parties need to agree that each person's point of view is valid. That is, if somebody says to me, I'm unhappy with you, I don't like what's happening in this relationship, instead of defending myself, denying and defending, I have to say, well, if you're saying ouch, There must be some need of, that you're having that's not satisfied. That's always valid. Let's look at what that need is. Let's see how I'm interacting with your getting or not getting that need satisfied. So everybody, in any conflict, the parties have to be honored. And it has to be realized that, they're coming from a valid place. They're saying, something's wrong. I'm not getting a basic need satisfied. And then what has to happen is the parties have to agree to figure out how to get everybody's needs satisfied. The United States and whoever we're having a conflict with has to say, okay, I see you got this need. How can we help you get your needs satisfied? And we got this need. How can you help us get our needs satisfied? And that's what's going to create the resolution of this conflict. It's not that one person's right or one person's wrong. It's that everybody, you can't help every moment of your life. You can't help everything you think, feel, and do has to do with the need that you have to remain alive. And therefore, the motivations that the basic needs that need to be satisfied. So when you relate to yourself, you can't say there's something wrong with me. You can say there's something I'm learning about myself if I'm going ouch. And when people are contesting, you can't say there's something wrong with you. They can say, you have to say there's a basic need that, or needs that are not being satisfied. Let's look at the strategies that will help that to happen. I think that therapy is about strategy. All right, so let's hear what you say about it. This is not the only way to look at happiness, but it's a very powerful way to look at happiness. So let's see what you say in the next 5 minutes. Okay. So Michael's first hand, so I'm going to give him a question.
But we must be very careful not to confuse the strategy with the need. And a lot of problems happen when we attach to the strategy.
Yeah, the need is always valid. The strategy can suck. That's a terrible strategy for trying to get a need. Let's try a different one. Okay. I'm going to run around with this thing.
You know, you mentioned that, you know, at the beginning of when the non-living universe changed into living universe, you know, it started off with a single cell. And the single cell, of course, learned how to multiply and become multicellular system. But then they start fighting among themselves. Now, they figured out that in order for us to continue living, we have to cooperate. And this is very important to mention.
What's her name? The woman, there was a population biologist who came here many years ago.
Elizabeth Satoris
came here many years ago.
She quoted Otto Voices, which was our ultimate conclusion after living months or years on an island, that survival determined everything nature does. And that gave her optimism in the current fear of climate decay. She thinks that nature is imbued with enough imagination to overcome any challenge.
Yeah, I think that's true. And another thing Elizabeth Satoris said that I thought was really interesting is to address what Abraham just said. Immature biological systems compete. Mature biological systems cooperate. As things evolve, life figures out that the most life will continue due to cooperation versus competition. It furthers life better to cooperate than to compete, because then only some life. Let's keep going. Okay. So Richard, can I hand this up? I'm just going to run around.
No, I was just curious about in the current political environment. Sometimes I have a hard time understanding, and I know maybe because we live in Santa Barbara and we may be more liberal, but I have a hard time understanding the people that support Trump. And I guess what I kind of want to get down to is the basic needs that they feel he's satisfied, and we can have dialogue about, you know, our basic needs as well, rather than going into our egos and having a conflict. But there's obviously, you know, definite basic needs that are being met by supporting them. So we just have to each understand what those things are on a base level, and maybe you know, be more open about that.
I totally agree. That's the problem, you know, we talk about this a lot, but everybody understands this. The problem with the world is everybody says, I'm right and you're wrong, you know. The Republicans and Democrats are instead of honoring one another. So why do people support the current knuckle drag as Sarsai wrote said, that means that the current knuckle drag chief? Because the one obvious need that he's satisfying that people really need is safety. You know, he's addressing safety. And through fear, unfortunately, but he's addressing safety.
Sadness me that in all our education, if you're not exposed to something spiritual, we are always addressing the material and the biological, and there's a threat of loss. And whenever there's a threat of loss, there's fear. And in order for some transcendence, there has to be trust in a higher level or power of existence. That's not really taught in the U.S. And when I travel to other cultures, I spent some time in China, they are not in this fear mode. I'm not talking about Hong Kong. I'm talking about this surrender of this idea that we're just material and biological. And even scientists, they're realizing we can't explain what spirit is. And I think we can be addicted, and I'm very much addicted to the way my mind figures things out, but I have to let go of that because I will never stop being on my phone for more information. And that's my desire for more understanding, but I have to let go of that and trust that I'll be guided. And I think that's whether it's, you know, a child, a family, a relationship, a community, or this global thing we're all in, even this climate, when we have fear, we want to control it. And I think it's going to come to a point where we realize we can't totally control, be responsible for some things, but we can't ultimately, because we're all going to disappear anyway.
So what Jeanette brings up is how the role spirituality plays in our happiness or unhappiness. And if one has a connection to spirit or a feeling of essence, then it transforms how the needs can be met. It gives a way to feel safe and whole and well and supported and connected and unified. You know, it brings into all these basic needs another level of satisfaction. I think that people don't do okay without that spiritual connection, but they do better with it. An apology after all this,
which is, this is a very cerebral, very heady class. There was no video, no other kind of stuff like that. I won't do this very often. I thought I'd do it today just because I thought I'd do it. But next week, we're going to kind of go from this kind of lofty cerebral level to something that's happening in the world right now that's very concrete and very concerning.
What is it?
Oh, I'm not going to tell you. Okay, I'll come next week. All right, so I'll see you in a week. Have a good week.